Hello and welcome to Truth in Journalism, a radio broadcast dedicated to applying the Word of God to current events. Well, today on Truth in Journalism, we're going to give you part one of a two-part series about religion in culture. Today's article is from the Religion News Service by Jonathan Merritt and is entitled, Evangelicals Perfected Cancel Culture, Now It's Coming for Them. Liking a tweet is technically free, but one Alabama megachurch is paying a hefty price. This month, Chris Hodges, senior pastor of the Church of the Highlands, an evangelical congregation with 60,000 members spread across 24 locations, came under fire after screenshots were shared online showing the pastor liking several posts by Charlie Kirk, a controversial pro-Trump activist. The posts in question were considered racially insensitive and, among other things, questioned whether white privilege actually exists. These actions sparked outcry from Birmingham residents, including the pastor of at least one black church, who was already displeased that Hodges' church has been planting white congregations in black neighborhoods to which they had no connection. Hodges attempted to quell the furor by deleting his social media accounts and tearfully apologizing to his congregation, but Birmingham's Board of Education, which leased two public high schools to the church, was unconvinced. The board abruptly canceled Church of Highlands' six-year lease, prohibiting the church from continuing to meet in the schools. The city's housing authority also terminated a partnership under which the church provided various social services to the residents. Hodges has been canceled, a term for what happens when people, most often on social media but increasingly in real life, band together and employ shaming tactics to block a person from having a platform. It means boycotting the target's businesses, refusing to consume their books or films, or pressuring friends, colleagues, and activists to denounce them or formally cut ties. Ironically, evangelical Christians who now decry what happened to Hodges are well practiced at this treatment. While cancel culture may be a recent phenomenon, public scapegoating, shaming, and silencing tactics are not. Following the cultural upheaval that began in the 1960s, conservative Christians bathed in a sense of loss. By the mid-1970s, traditional American Christian values were on the decline in favor of a new kind of pluralism. To protect themselves, leaders of the newly formed religious right argued a kind of Christian cultural separatism in which all that was deemed evil would be cut from all that was deemed holy. Among their enemies were liberal politicians, social justice activists, feminist professors, abortion rights advocates, secularists, pornographers, humanists, atheists, Hollywood moguls, civil rights leaders, working moms, and stay-at-home dads. White evangelicals' cancel culture did not just target those outside the camp. If a member of the community dared to deviate from what the majority called orthodoxy, that person too risked being run out of town. Beginning in the 1970s, a group of Southern Baptist led by the now disgraced preacher and seminary president Paige Patterson and other conservative leaders sought to purge their denomination of any hint of liberal theology. Seminary professors, church employees, and pastors lost their jobs or were shamed out of the convention during this denominational civil war. Known as the conservative resurgence or the fundamentalist takeover, depending on your point of view, the coup Patterson led was a massive exercise of cancel culture. Only true believers allowed. Anyone who crossed the masses was expelled quickly and forcefully. Now the tables have turned. Something shifted in 2016 after the election of Donald Trump. The rapidly proliferating groups of evangelicals had been marginalizing and attacking women, people of color, feminists, immigrants, LGBTQ people, recognized that they had their own pulpits on social media. They began to sermonize back. This great awakening has flipped the script on cancel culture, and white evangelicals are calling for a rewrite. This is how Alabama pastor Chris Hodges found himself shut out of his high school auditorium rentals, and why conservative Christians and their political allies quickly set up a howl of fury. The Family Research Council's Tony Perkins, a longtime friend of Hodges, claimed that the cancel culture was tantamount to mob tactics and leftist intolerance. Former Attorney General and Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions called it an attack on both religious liberty and freedom of speech, while Donald Trump Jr. tweeted that canceling an evangelical leader like Hodges was absolutely insane. Ed Stetzer, executive director of the Wheaton College Billy Graham Center, called for the shaming of Hodges as weaponized social media, comparing it to a pitchforks and torches scene from Frankenstein. A reasonable argument can be made that in Hodges' case, the punishment far exceeded the crime. But such an argument must also take into account from whence this problem arose. They are not victims of a liberal culture out to obliterate them from acceptable society. They are the collateral damage of a culture they helped create. They are reaping what they have sowed. Evangelicals' boycott for thee but not for me approach is not just drenched in irony. It's a cautionary tale about a central idea taught in most religions. What goes around often comes back around. So I've read this article more times than I normally read anything in preparation to do one of these broadcasts, and I certainly have to say that this article makes me very uncomfortable, and it's hard to put a finger on exactly why. Part of it is what appears to be a very subtle bias against conservative evangelicals and some of the language that's used. For instance, it says in the article that evangelicals had been marginalizing women and people of color. Okay, well, how? I mean, that's just given as a blanket statement. For instance, as well, when he talks about the canceling of Hodges, he says, and I'm quoting, "A reasonable argument can be made that in Hodges' case, the punishment far exceeds the crime." Okay, so is this his argument? Also, is he asserting that what Hodges did was, in fact, a crime? Or another example, earlier in the piece, and I'm quoting, says, "The posts in question were considered racially insensitive and, among other things, questioned whether white privilege actually exists." Once again, we have the phraseology making it seem as though questioning whether white privilege exists is a ridiculous and possibly bigoted thing to do. Granted, he may simply be recording the facts, but I'm not so sure that's what he's doing. Now, I've read several articles that Mr. Merritt has published, and a couple things appear to be pretty clear. One, he's very intelligent. Two, he's extremely careful with his words. And three, he's very careful to appear neutral when, in fact, he's not neutral. Now, I admit being intelligent and careful with words are good things, but when intelligence and rhetoric are used to disguise bias, that's just being dishonest. Now, like I said above, Mr. Merritt is very intelligent and careful with his words, so I can't say for certain that he's using rhetoric to hide bias, but it certainly feels that way. Also, as far as using words, like he says from whence, and from whence, it just grates on me. It's wrong. It's whence. From whence is already implied in the word whence. Whence means from where, just like hence means from here, and thence means from there, just like, you know, whither, hither, and thither mean to where, to here, to there. Anyways, that just really bugs me, so I have to say it, or I got to get it out of my system. Anyways, now, another thing that made me uncomfortable about this article was the attempt to equate Christian boycotts with what's currently going on in our society. And admittedly, I had to cut it for length, and Mr. Merritt gave a large number of examples, and he makes a strong case. And it would take quite a bit of time to lay out the case for whether or not the boycotting of conservative evangelical right is the same as the cancel culture and deplatforming from today's leftists. I don't feel they're the same, but maybe there is no difference. Indeed, maybe the only difference is that conservative Christian canceling was coming from the religious viewpoint of evangelical Christianity, whereas the deplatforming of the left is coming from the religious viewpoint of the secularist. Now, generally, when we look at two people doing the same thing and we say that one is right and one is wrong, we do so if we're being honest and reasonable by saying that the person doing the one thing who's right is doing so because what they are doing is for a good cause. So, for example, if we look at, you know, two soldiers during World War II and they're both killing people, but one is an American and one is a Nazi, we think that the American is right to kill people and the Nazi is wrong to kill people. And you could say, well, they're both killing people, so they can't both be right or they can't both be wrong. Well, yeah, you can if the cause for which the Nazi was fighting was wrong, which I believe it was, right? So we understand that. So it's possible that when we compare evangelical cancel culture, boycotting Disney, for example, and we say, well, evangelical Christian cancel culture is good because it upholds Christian morality. We compare that to secularist cancel culture, for example, getting Pastor Hodges deplatformed for liking a video, and we say, and that's bad because it silences Christian voices. What we're really driving at is not that we think cancel culture is bad, but that we think that silencing Christian voices is bad. So we're against silencing opponents. We're against cancel culture, not because we're against, you know, silencing heretics and silencing opponents, but we're against the wrong silencing the wrong opponents. People are okay with canceling opponents when the person being canceled holds an anathematized worldview, but it's wrong when it affects somebody holding our worldview. Now, my mom would say that what's good for the goose is good for the gander, and you can't have it both ways. And I'm wondering if that's true. I honestly don't have answers right now. I'm trying to understand how the apostles would have dealt with this issue, because Peter, James, John, all the rest, they faced immense persecution, physical persecution. They faced arrest, torture, and death at the hands of their opponents, but I don't see anybody in the Bible calling for freedom of religion. The Bible doesn't recognize freedom of religion or freedom of speech, for that matter. In the biblical worldview, there's Yahwism, faith in the one true God, and paganism, which is everything else. And God tells the Israelites that certain forms of speech and certain forms of worship not only cannot be tolerated, but those who engage in them must be killed. God is plain that those who worship foreign gods, especially those who entice others to do so, are to be mercilessly exterminated. Why? Well, for several reasons. One, because God demands worship and obedience, and he rightly deserves it. He's right to demand it. Two, God called and covenanted with Israel, and those were the terms of the covenant. Three, worshiping false gods leads to society being undermined and destroyed. And when we look through the scriptures, we see that religious tolerance was not a viewpoint that was held by the Israelites. In other nations, even those who purported to offer religious tolerance, like Cyrus and the Persians and later the Romans, that was not really religious tolerance in the way that we think of it, especially when we see later the Romans would have religious tolerance as long as you also worship Caesar as a god. And throughout the centuries, even after the church grew and became the official religion of Rome, and then of many European kingdoms, there was little or no concept of total freedom of religion. Jews and Muslims who lived in medieval Europe were tolerated, although sometimes and often they were not, but certainly there was no thought to take Catholicism off of the pedestal as the official religion of the various and sundry kingdoms, principalities, duchies, republics, and city-states. During and after the Protestant Reformation, agreements were made that there would be a generalized European policy of quius regio, eius religio, or whose region, his religion, meaning that whatever the religion of the local prince was the religion of the populace. And this meant that if you were a Huguenot in France, or a Mennonite in Holland, or a Protestant in England, or later a Catholic in England, you would be treated as an enemy of the state. Menno Simons, of course, he didn't even actually argue for freedom of speech or religion, but he argued that persecuting peaceful Anabaptists was evil because the Anabaptists were not the heretics, they were the true believers. Menno didn't believe that it was necessarily wrong to punish actual heretics. His point was that he wasn't one. Moreover, he argued that Mennonites were theologically correct, more holy than the surrounding society, and peaceful and obedient to the government. We see glimmers and inklings of freedom of religion, but it isn't really fleshed out. Indeed, all throughout the wars of religion, there was this fundamental assumption that heretical beliefs undermine society, which is a pretty universal facet of the pre-modern worldview. Well, Europe was so devastated after the wars of religion and so embittered against it that history gave us the rise of rationalism and modernism and these attempts to replace religious beliefs as the basis of society with liberal ideals, freedom of thought, religion, inquiry, speech. Classical liberalism in its purest form demanded tolerance for all beliefs and schools of thought, but as history has shown, removing God as the basis of society and replacing him with human government has some pretty drastic effects. For example, the French Revolution, Stalinist Russia, Nazism, and the Chinese Cultural Revolution. What the 20th century has shown us, and what we're seeing now in America right now, is that while it may be possible to replace the God of the Bible as being the basis of society, it is impossible to replace religion. All men worship, and all men engage in religion, and all cultures have a dominant religion with beliefs, morals, and rituals. What history has shown us is that the great experiment of classical liberalism has failed. Classical liberalism believed that it could create cohesive and peaceful societies if religion were dethroned from the basis of society and government. History has shown that that is an impossibility. You cannot get rid of religion. You can only pick which religion you will build your society upon. And that's what we're seeing today. Today in society, we aren't seeing a battle between two political positions. We aren't seeing the vengeful turnabout against evangelicalism as punishment for its past perfection of a cancel culture. We aren't even seeing hypocrisy from woke scolds doing the thing they decried or evangelicals decrying the things they did. What we're seeing is a society-wide conflict between several religious positions. On one side are the woke, those who advocate an entire restructuring of society along racial, sexual, and economic lines to create an equitable society. On the other side are conservative Christians who found themselves strange bedfellows with atheists and agnostics and others who are trying to preserve the classical liberal values of speech, free speech, freedom of religion. What we're seeing is that the surfacing of an open conflict between ultimately wokeism and Christianity is existing. One wishes to tear down and remake America. The other wishes to stop the destruction and work on internal reformation rather than structural revolution. It was Christians largely who created the framework, and it was Christians' societies that were able to allow classical liberalism to thrive. But now we're seeing that classical liberalism is simply intolerable to the woke. They demand ideological uniformity. Not unity, uniformity. They demand that everyone think and act as they decide. There is no freedom of speech or freedom of religion to this new religion. It is totalitarian. And I believe that things are only going to get more bitter and more divisive, and I believe that soon and very soon we could see a dramatic increase in political violence. Not just riots, but counter-riots. Freedom of religion in America looks to be dying. Next week, we'll talk about how the church should respond. I hope you'll join us next week when we conclude this pair of broadcasts and we discuss how the church should respond to this new totalitarian and decidedly anti-Christian form of religion. How should the church respond living in this culture without freedom of religion? How should the church respond as we leave a society built upon classical liberal ideals and enter a pre-modern society where Christianity will once again be a persecuted faith. We'll talk about that next week, and I hope you'll join us then for another exciting episode of Truth and Journalism. Thank you, and may God bless your day to His glory.